Science Faction is a science education podcast for adults only. Do not allow your kids or sensitive pets to listen.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 280. Science Faction, the origin of multicellular life.
This is Science Faction, the birds and the bees, if I'm not right.
No, you are not right. You brought up the birds and the bees last week, actually. This seems to be a common theme for you.
Well, this one actually seems more appropriate. Last time, I think I jumped the gun. This time...
Well, I mean, it wouldn't be the birds and the bees, because both of those are multicellular organisms. We couldn't talk about the origin of multicellular life
okay,
if we were talking about them mating.
What is the bird and bee equivalent in the microbiotic world?
Now I'm just thinking of Jeff Goldblum. If instead of in the fly, he got mixed between a human and a fly, he got mixed between a bird and a bee. And that's even scarier.
You throw me off my game.
Life found a way.
I had a real question. You throw me off.
Indeed, we have been doing our Origins of series as our new opening bit. We talked about the origins of the universe. We talked about the origin of solar system. We talked about the origin of stars. I talked about the origin of the Earth, planets, and life on the Earth. And now we want to talk about multicellular life, which is obviously a pretty important story in this whole tale.
This is the incredibly boring birds and the bees story.
Okay.
This is the exact opposite of showing pornography to a kid to explain their curiosity.
So we have to distinguish between prokaryotes and eukaryotes. When we had started, we had talked about the origin of life, and we had talked about how you can get a living thing from a non-living components, and that's literally what our body does all the time, and that in the right circumstances, you can actually have this spontaneously originate in an atmosphere that did not have oxygen. But from there, you have very simple life. And for a long time, we believe, possibly for billions of years, that all there were these prokaryotic life forms. We still have prokaryotes now. They outnumber us by a lot. There's a lot more prokaryotes than there are eukaryotes. One, because they're small and single-celled, simple. But two, because they've been around for much longer. And these prokaryotic life, they don't have the same type of cell walls. They don't have the individual organelles that we would have with the cell walls in them in eukaryotic life. So eukaryotes are generally much, much more complicated life forms.
Do you think if we had harder working baleen whales, we would be able to reduce the number of prokaryotes out there, at least in our oceans?
They take in a lot of krill and stuff, but those are still eukaryotic life for the most part. Now, they do take in, I think, some cyanobacteria, which are multicellular prokaryotes, which we're going to discuss in a little bit. Basically, a way to think about it is early simple life is prokaryotic. We do still have prokaryotic life around. More complex life, which can still be single-celled, is eukaryotic. It has separate organelles. It has mitochondria, which kind of run the energy part of the cell. For those of you guys who haven't heard us talk about it before, mitochondria are very interesting. They carry their own DNA because we think they're actually the infusion of one organism into another a long time ago. And that one organism, which we still carry the genes around in our body today, it becomes the powerhouse of that cell. It's what fuels that cell. So imagine there are two little blobs a long time ago. One of them overtakes the other one, and the smaller one becomes part of the larger one. And the job that smaller one has is to be the engine for it. It basically produces all the energy for it. Nowadays, we still have that in our cells. We have mitochondria, and you inherit that DNA pretty much only from your mother. It goes down the matrilineal line. I say that pretty much because actually this week we just had a paper come out that stated that you can actually, in very, very unique cases, get some mitochondria from your father.
Clearly it's happened at least once. But what are the odds that every time an organism eats something, that thing will become a parasitic or perhaps...
In that case, not even parasitic. They're symbiotic.
Or symbiotic life form. Like,
right.
At what point do I
incredibly
eat
a, low. Incredibly low.
How many hamburgers
low.
Do I have to eat before a hamburger helps me fight cancer?
Well, no. You meant how many hamburgers do you have to eat before you become a half cow, half man?
Or I receive a special powerhouse that allows me to be an NFL-caliber athlete somewhere within my body.
Or you get udders. How about that? What if you just get udders?
Maybe that's the secret.
Eating something and assimilating its powers is kind of how the major transition in life from prokaryotes to eukaryotes went, because we think, you know, it ate it and then just happened to not digest it.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with mitochondria, and that's what happened with chloroplasts as well, where they ate a photosynthesizing little organism and then it just stuck around and gave them this powerhouse within themselves.
Right. And what's interesting is some of the cellular evidence seems to suggest that it might have happened because of a viral infection. So again, we talked before about bacteriophages, viruses that affect different types of bacteria can affect single cell things as well. So what we think might have happened is because we've seen traces of specific viruses in these very basal parts of DNA that's needed for eukaryotic life, what we think might have happened is this virus messed up the DNA in a specific prokaryote that caused something to happen where instead of absorbing and eating it, it absorbed it and incorporated it into its system. So it's the right thing at the right time that would create multicellular life. Now, here's the thing. We know that multicellular life has been created multiple times, 46 times that we know of, depending on how you define it, in multiple different animal lineages, plant lineages, fungal lineages, bacterial lineages. Like we talked about, there's even prokaryotic multicellular life in terms of certain cyanobacteria that fit the definition. So this type of thing is set up in nature to happen. It's not one of those once in the history of Earth type things.
And we can actually, even though we're talking about things that happened billions and billions of years ago, we can study this in the lab. Just this past month, a paper came out where they engineered a yeast strain to be deficient in its mitochondria, and they inserted an E. coli strain that they had also engineered into it that they made produce mitochondria-like products and also made it deficient in some genes that would have let it be living on its own, so it had to rely on nutrients obtained from the yeast.
Right.
So they made sort of a pseudo mitochondria out of a bacterium and got this thing living, and that's work that's being done right now.
Oh, that's very interesting.
And people have also done experimental evolutions to get multicellularity. Like if you just have a group of yeast and there's a protist that's preying on them, mm-hmm. And it only has a mouth that's a certain size, after a certain number of generations, the yeast will start sticking to each other because that gives them a competitive advantage that the protist can't eat them. People have studied this and they start to even specialize the yeast where they will have budding ones that form these stalks and then break off to form new multicellular things. So it can happen quite rapidly.
Well, and that's really interesting you bring it up because it brings up one of my favorite all-time creatures in biology, which is the slime mold. And the slime mold's a great example of how that can happen, where you can almost essentially go from a prokaryote to a eukaryote, or at least in this case, slime mold, single-cell eukaryote to a multicell eukaryote in a short amount of time. And what this does is, this is an evolution over millions and millions of years. This is a creature that lives its life as a single-cell organism. Amoebas do this and a few others do it. And then when something happens, usually they get stressed, they gather together to form a single living thing, basically. It's called a grex. And this
is like a Pokemon that evolved from a grex.
Yeah. What it is basically a slug. So imagine all of these single cell little creatures coming together to form this slug. The slug then moves like a slug. It crawls like a slug. It then gets to a different location and it becomes a fruiting body like a regular multicellular animal. So what happens is the part that forms the stalk of it ends up sprouting these spores that then go off and pollinate and go to places that the individual creatures themselves couldn't have got to. They come together to form a Voltron. They move someplace and then become this like flower that spreads out and sends the fruiting bodies everywhere. It's amazing.
I have questions about the physics of this creature, but I'm going to ask it in the only way that I know how. Let's just say that we got shrunk down and we had to fend this thing off. Would fighting it be similar to fighting a biological T-1000?
So,
like in free form every time?
I think it probably would, yeah, because they're all single cell. So they would just kind of, it would be a very slow T-1000.
Could it form blades?
I'm going to have to say yeah. Yeah, I'm going to have to say that.
Impersonate my mom?
Without a doubt, a slime mold can form blades. And yes, indeed, sound exactly like your mom over the telephone.
You heard it here on Science Faction.
Call to Damien. So there's this idea that, A, maybe this is kind of how multicellular life came about in one of these 46 times. Maybe it happened in a temporary thing where something is single cell, it comes together to be multicell and then goes back to being single cell later on. Maybe that is the origin of some of these things. There's also this idea of ratcheting in biology. And if you know what a ratchet is, it only turns one way, right? So what ends up happening is if you have something that goes in one direction, you know, like Dr. Troy was just talking about, if you have something that goes, okay, this needs something else to be dependent, the further it goes in that direction, the further it gets from being able to go back. So if you have things that get slightly more and more dependent on one another, that ratcheting, they're getting further and further along with no ability to take a step backwards. At some point, they get to a point where they can no longer live without one another. They're now in some kind of complete symbiosis state, and they can't get back past that ratchet point. And so, therefore, going forward towards a permanent multicellular life form is the only way to go. So we don't know exactly how many times this happens. We know that it happened a few times in plants. We know that it happened a few times in animals, a few times in fungi, a few times in certain types of bacteria. So we know that it can occur multiple times. But when we start seeing like actual multicellular animals, really well represented is after the Cambrian explosion. Now, we do have evidence of multicellular life that comes before the Cambrian explosion. That's about 540 million years ago, around there, about half a billion. We have some life, but remember, this is very soft-bodied life. They're not going to leave.
Fat, doughy.
Yeah.
Never make it through boot
camp. Mollycoddlers, every one of them.
Mollycoddlers. Love your 1930s insults, like emasculating insults. Oh, father, please approve of me.
You doughy mollycoddler. Yeah.
I'll grow up to be the best Teddy Roosevelt ever.
Not with that polio. Sorry, wrong Roosevelt. So that soft-bodied life doesn't always preserve well in the fossil record, and that becomes a problem. For a long time, we didn't think there was any Precambrian multicellular life because it was very, very hard to find. But what we do see is that right starting in the Cambrian with the Cambrian explosion, we have an explosion of this multicellular life. That
Michael Bay, boom, boom, boom.
Totally, and it takes over. This biological radiation happens where basically this living thing is so successful that it spreads out into all these different niches. And because it's multicellular, it has such an advantage over these single cellular animals. You can do so many more complex things. You can get bigger. You can essentially get invulnerability, like Dr. Troy was just talking about, to a lot of the stuff that the single cell organisms can do to you. You can occupy entire niches that have never been occupied before because you can do different things than everything else that's alive. And because of that, you have this radiation to all these different body types, all these different multicellular animals that all look very interesting. They're not all like the animals we think of. We think of animals, a lot of times we think of mammals, modern day things, right? Way before mammals. Think of things that looked more like 10-foot long millipedes than any dog or cat you've ever seen.
Animal from the Muppets.
Yes.
Animal House.
Yeah, Animal House.
I think there was an 80s character before my time called the Danimal.
So this stuff looked really different, looked bizarre. We've had so many extinctions that most of those lineages have died out. It's only through happenstance that the lineages that exist now are here. Now, obviously, there's a lot of natural selection and stuff, but there's extinction event after random extinction event that took out entire clades.
After man-made extinction event.
That took out entire clades of living things, and that's the reason we don't have 10-foot-long millipedes running around. Also, there's differences in oxygen levels and whatnot, but for the most part, we have entire groups that got kind of taken out of the family tree of all living things that are currently around, and because of that, they're not there anymore. But during this Cambrian explosion, you had this weird array of crazy, bizarre animals. If you went back to, let's say, 500 million years ago, after the Cambrian explosion, you started looking around, you would quite literally think you got dropped on a different planet. Nothing around you would resemble what you consider life today.
It wouldn't really matter because you would probably not survive past 10 minutes in that environment.
Maybe.
Biologically. I mean, with 15-foot millipedes running around?
Yeah, I don't know. See, I don't know how great at predators they were. I feel like we have more honed and refined predators by now. I feel like you could probably outrun one of them.
The lack of oxygen would probably get us, though.
Isn't there too much oxygen?
No, more oxygen. Because the problem is, before you had all these breathing animals, you still had cyanobacteria for 2 billion years beforehand that were photosynthesizing and created this massive amount of oxygen in the air, which is why you could have 10-foot-long millipedes.
So you're saying this millipede just didn't have the mouth to consume me?
I feel like you could beat it in a foot race or climb something.
I'd have to fall asleep at some point. And by the way, that's just one of the many species I'd have to avoid.
Yeah, fair enough. You know what? Let's try it.
Fire up the time machine. Let's just set the timer. I'm coming back in 10 minutes or I'm not.
Welcome to Cambrian Park.
It'd be far more horrifying because it'd be so much more alien.
But it is neat, and it's funny to think about. So you had life going around. We know we had life 3.5 billion years ago, something around there. While we can argue about where exactly decent-sized animals come into play, we don't have solid evidence for it till around 600 million years. Now, you'll see people, and they'll quote some things that are 1 billion years old, maybe even 2 billion, and when they're looking at these large mats that could be multicellular life, but are also could just as likely be a mat of single-cell life that is not really doing anything multicellular.
Like a bath mat? What do you mean, a mat?
Exactly, yeah, just a big, flat grouping of them. But certainly by about 600 some odd million years ago, we have multicellular life. We have animal type stuff that's running around. If we look at that, that means for 2 billion years, we had single cell life before we had any kind of these complex multicell life. That's pretty impressive. It means that single cell life can do stuff pretty well on its own. But it does mean that once those animals took off, that's not that long ago. Think of that. 500 million years ago in the grand scheme of life is not that long. That means that, you know, when you think of the age of dinosaurs and stuff, the age of dinosaurs is closer to us than it is to that. But think of what that means for that entire range of biota. Most of what we think of when we think of ancient life, you probably think of dinosaurs. If we think of ancient multicellular life, right? Well, we're closer to dinosaurs than dinosaurs are to those Cambrian animals. So think how much life, how many millions and millions of years of animals existed essentially without us even being aware currently. When we conceptualize that time period, we don't even think of what those animals look like or what they could be or what they are. It's a really interesting time in Earth's history, from about 600 million years ago till you could argue the beginning of the pseudo-proto-reptile age in somewhere like 300 million years ago.
Thank goodness we have heroes like you and other archaeologists who help dig up the dinosaur bones that will allow us to unravel this mystery.
Obviously, one of the important things of multicellular life and why it's so important to the history of the Earth is not just us, not just human beings, but all the other animals, all the plants, all the fungi. Basically, you can't do complex things until you get multicellular to some extent. You know, we've seen some photosynthesis from cyanobacteria. Obviously, that can happen with prokaryotic life. That's unicellular. We can see a lot of that kind of stuff. But once you get multicellular, you can have brains. You can get up and walk around. You can do complex tasks. You can have everything from a whale to a human being, and we get past all of the things of these are minor protists doing different, slightly different things through the environment.
Yes, the advantage is clearly to multicellular life, but I wish that we could adapt single cell life's ability to spontaneously get superpowers in the environment.
That's true with the horizontal gene transfer. They can snag the genes of other living things and then just suddenly use them. That, I guess you're right. That is the one. You know what, Damien? Go ahead. I give you permission. Become single-celled.
I've been waiting for the surgery. Thank you for your permission, Bobby. Can you sign this permission slip?
You've told me since we were kids that you were a prokaryote born in a eukaryote's body.
It was my way of saying I didn't really want to participate in society. I just want to lay on a couch all day or any surface, dry or wet.
Speaking of a wet surface, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. And with me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damien Mercado. Damien, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing great, but I was wondering if you could refer to me as the birthday boy for the rest of the show.
It is your birthday.
It is.
But no. And, of course, and our scientist for the afternoon, Dr. Troy. Dr. Troy, how are you doing?
Good. It's always fun to be on.
And it's great to have you back. If you want to check out some of the articles that we're about to cover or some of the ones we've covered in the past, you can go ahead and check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com. And if you want to tweet us an ungoogleable question, we haven't had a good one in a little while. So if you've been sitting on a really good ungoogleable question for us, remember the requirements, obviously has to not be googleable. So it has to be a somewhat subjective question, has to have some kind of scientific basis. We've had some good ones before. If you could go back in time to any point in time to try and change something and make the world better, what would you do? What technologies will change the world the most in the coming future? A lot of that kind of stuff. So if you've been thinking about one of those, send it our way. We actually do a fair amount of research on this. So we will kind of delve pretty deep to give you a somewhat subjective but still pretty informed answer. Go ahead and tweet us at Faction Science. But for now, let's get right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right, article number one, CRISPR babies.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing worse than a baby that's undercooked. You want them crispy, you want them...
You know what I'm thinking of is a baby that's just been left in the sun too long. Like, this is a Miami Beach baby, for sure.
CRISPR actually sounds to me like an unwanted love child of those Rice Krispie treat elves. Like,
okay.
Dad, it's me, CRISPR. I've come to sell cereal.
Indeed. So we talked about CRISPR before. It's obviously a gene editing technique that we literally stole this from bacteria. Bacteria use this particular thing to cut up intruders, to cut up viral intruders as they come in. And we use this exact same thing to cut out and insert different genes. We've evolved past the first few generations. We're at CRISPR-Cas9 currently. So this is a technique that we are using that is really changing the game. It's also, by the way, much cheaper than it used to be. When we actually first started this show back in 2013, we were talking about CRISPR and how expensive it was at the time. Now you can literally buy home CRISPR kits. You can do your own genetic experimentation on yourself, as we've spoken about a few people doing.
Yeah, didn't that one guy, we talked about the one guy giving himself herpes.
Right.
But did we follow up on that same guy died? Yeah, he tried out an AIDS vaccine on himself and basically went home sick one day, stayed incommunicado for 3 weeks.
Wow.
And just died.
Now, did he die from what he actually did, or did he have a terminal illness he was trying to cure that he later died from?
Unknown. I think he was trying to show how harmless, you know, just fucking with your genome would be. And
whoops!
I liked, in my mind, in his 3 weeks in seclusion, I pictured a Jeff Goldblum fly-like moment
right.
Where he's, kill me!
I just pictured that if he was trying to prove that it didn't mess with your genome and then he died from it only weeks later at the funeral, legally speaking, there had to be some guy with a trombone going, whoa, whoa.
All right, go on with the horror story that you're about to unveil.
This is a story from China in which a researcher has apparently used CRISPR-Cas9 to modify human embryos and then bring those embryos to term. Now, that's actually a very big deal because currently that is against basically the rules of every major scientific organization and country that is experimenting with this stuff, vis-a-vis a 2015 declaration that basically said we can't use this on viable embryos. Now, you could use this if you wanted to test on human embryos, which we do. They can test on stuff, and then usually I think they have to, by 14 days, get rid of it. They have to keep this embryo from growing out of control. And you can technically also use it on existing humans. So if you're a grown adult, you theoretically could go into trials and certain kind of clinical trials to get your DNA modified. The reason this is such a big deal is because you're essentially affecting the germline cells. So you're affecting this child's DNA that's going to be born, and that's going to affect the next generation and the next generation and the next generation. And that is something that molecular biologists are very wary of doing because of unintended consequences. CRISPR is way better than our previous tools in terms of modifying genes. We used to have very much a hand grenade method of doing it. Can we modify this gene? Kind of, but we blow up everything around it.
Good news, we killed the roaches, but your house crumbles behind
you. Yeah, it's a lot of that. CRISPR is much more exact. However, it's still not perfect. And one of the fears is you mess up something big, it gets in the gene lines, and you can cause a lot of problems down the line. Well, this particular researcher decided that he was going to do it anyway. He took a sabbatical from his research institution in China so that technically, because China signed on to this agreement as well. So technically, he was not violating the agreement and neither was the Chinese university he worked for. Because again, this isn't against the law. There's not a law saying, hey, you can't use CRISPR-Cas9 on embryos that you intend to bring to full term. What there is a bunch of restrictions we put in place that say, because we all agree you can't do this, you can't get federal funding for it. It was a lot like the stem cell ban that George Bush put into place. He didn't say it's illegal to do this. What he said is, I'm going to restrict federal funding for it, which essentially in the U.S. made it illegal because you couldn't get funding to do so. This guy kind of went around about and said, you know what, I'll take a sabbatical and I will then do it on my own time.
The scientific community has allowed the supervillain community to flaunt its laws for so long.
Yep.
China, it was only so long for China just said, why not us?
So these are the first ever that we know of modified born CRISPR babies. It's a pair of twins, and he modified them to take out a specific gene that makes them susceptible to HIV. That's a very noble cause. HIV is obviously something that worldwide is a huge problem. And his argument was, well, we need to do this. This is very unique for embryos that we need to actually go after because there's a lot of moms in the third world with HIV that can pass them on to their babies that are being born. If we modify those young babies, then in that sense, we would be able to keep them from being infected. So a lot of problems with that reasoning, including the fact that those people who are getting pregnant who have HIV are rarely doing so through labs.
When you say susceptible to HIV, are you referring to it in the way that we all are susceptible to HIV, that anybody who's not immune, or is it that they can't be in the same elevator as somebody with HIV?
Right.
That's
no.
Highly allergic.
No. So it makes them, so basically, I believe it actually affects part of the binding site of HIV that would keep it from being able to infect people, or at least make it very, very difficult for it to happen. That's a noble goal. I don't think you would need it for that case. And there's much easier ways to keep transmission from happening from mother to child, including antiretroviral drugs and a bunch of other stuff. So this seems like kind of a redundant use of that.
Well, unless he just wanted to let the child be able to use needles recreationally without fear of consequence.
That's true. It could have been that.
Yeah, I think most of the flack he's getting from this is because of his gene choice. He chose this gene and was targeting to introduce a natural variant, which makes it a lot better because you're not just doing some change that doesn't exist in the population.
Right.
So we do know that can exist in people and not have negative consequences for the most part. But also, you know, it's sort of knocking out this gene, and that may make you resistant to HIV, but we don't know all of the things it does. And actually, the people who are more resistant to HIV with that variant also have more severe symptoms from the flu, and there may be other negative things that we don't even know about. So it's kind of a, you know, very random change to make without really understanding all of the consequences behind it. Whereas if he had chosen something like two parents wanting to have a child without a congenital defect that we know, you know, a specific mutation we could fix, that would be a much more easy sell for a CRISPR need for engineering.
Right, like something like a Huntington's, right? So where that person is going to get the disease if they have the genetic marker, it's a horrible, horrible disease that takes over people's lives, ruins them. There's no cure or treatment for it. If you were going after that, I think you would have a lot more support on your side. Also, there is the idea that let's say all that stuff that you had just mentioned was accounted for. Let's say they had said, hey, we found out that this is, like we said, we've studied normal variants and we're sure that this is safe and blah, 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 blah. Can you be sure that the particular modification you're doing with the particular Cas9 that you're using isn't going to also accidentally modify another part of the genome? And the answer right now is no.
Yeah, that's absolutely the other reason he's getting a lot of flack, is because these are very much still in their infancy to the point where we don't want to just start manipulating humans at will, because there are likely off-target effects. And in fact, he did not get exactly the edits he was wanting when he edited these children.
Especially when it's not a needed one. You know, again, these two objections go together, because if you had something where he's like, yeah, you know what? You're right. There could be a mistake. But also, this person is going to get Huntington's otherwise. So you know what? It's worth the mistake. In the case of the HIV, those twins are not necessarily going to get HIV. Their mom, by the way, is not HIV infected. So that is not something that they would worry about in terms of transmission from them to them.
I'm about to use some words I don't know, so bear with me. If your goal is to change the phenotype, would it be safer and perhaps less detrimental to get those changes epigenetically than by messing with the code? I mean, or do we just not know enough about that?
You can't change everything with epigenetics. So epigenetics are basically usually methyl groups that get added that activate or deactivate parts of your genes, right? So we know that there can be epigenetic changes to us. You know, you get exposed to certain chemicals, certain environments, certain stresses. Parts of your genome can have methyl groups added to it, which activate or deactivate genes. Not all of your genes are susceptible to these methyl groups. They have to be in the right place, and they're not all 100% susceptible, even if they are susceptible themselves.
And we understand a lot less about epigenetics than we do regular genetics, mm-hmm. So certainly not at this point in time can we do that.
Yeah, I think you would actually probably be more likely to do damage trying to change something epigenetically than genetically, because we don't even have the CRISPR level of accuracy with that. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to use an analogy that I'm sure is very inappropriate. If epigenetics is your clothes and genes is you, I'm suggesting it'd be easier if, like, instead of like removing part of your body to lose weight, just dress in something that complements. You're saying we don't have advanced research enough in clothing technology
now.
To be able
everybody's
to dress
in horizontal stripes everywhere.
We need to get more gays in the gene world.
That's true.
To improve the fashion.
That is absolutely true. So it brings up a lot of these ethical questions. And now this genie is out of the bottle. Like, this has been done. And one of the things we see over and over again in science is once something has been done, it's pretty hard to keep it from being done again.
Couldn't you sterilize these children?
Yeah, but here's the deal. The research doors are now open, right? So now that this has happened, you better believe there's going to be other Chinese researchers, there's going to be Russian researchers. That same Korean researcher who is supposedly cloning children and allowing their parents to have them relive or whatever and cloning dogs, that guy is definitely going to do it. Like, everybody's going to do it. And again, CRISPR-Cas9 can literally be ordered as a home kit.
Sounds like that multinational science organization has to castrate a lot of kids.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, it will be an interesting thing, because this is one of those, the door has been opened, whether we like it or not. It has been opened. You are not going to put this genie back in the bottle. You will see more of this with 100% surety. There will be more embryo editing, not just the fact that he's got apparently an embryo that's in a woman right now that is currently going to be born a little bit later that's also edited.
But there will be a point when this is advantageous, like where we get the bugs worked out, where, hell, now do I want my kid, which X-Men superpower do I want my kid to have?
100%. And that becomes a big issue, is when do we start doing it? Because I'll tell you what, there are other groups who are all too happy to do it. It's the same problem we have with AI. We can say all we want. We're not going to develop AI because it's got all these problems and there's, you know, the eventual end of humanity is in the seeds of this. But at the same time, somebody's going to do it. When Russia figures out that with the right AI, 10 of their military planes can beat 100 of ours, they're going to develop it. And the same thing is true of genetic modification. When you figure out you can make your kid way, way smarter, way faster, way better, long-lived, insusceptible to cancer, whatever it is, people are going to go after those gains, even if there are potential risks to them.
Your analogy doesn't make sense, because in the CRISPR technology, at least the way I think most people envision it right now, there's a happy ending to that story.
Sure.
AI technology is like meth. Yes, you get some short-term advantages, but there is no happy ending to this story.
Well, I mean, you could argue that might be the case with CRISPR as well. You know, it might be that we have an inevitability where we altered our genes or we messed something up so badly that it becomes a problem later down the line. I don't know. I mean, I don't know that technically either is true. I think it's true with AI, but we don't know for sure.
You can call me dumb if you want. Like, you don't have to pull your punches.
Even though this guy was irresponsible and jumped the gun with this CRISPR editing when we don't know if it's safe yet, you know, people are going to be so looking forward to the data coming from these children and if they actually are perfectly healthy in every way and it didn't introduce bad negative consequences. So just this guy taking the initiative and doing this may have pushed this forward by decades, potentially, if we would have otherwise waited to be really, really certain that nothing bad was going to happen. And, you know, it is possible that there's nothing wrong with them right now, even though in one of the cases, because he edited two children, one got exactly the change he was looking for. One was it actually got like a 5 amino acid deletion in the gene, which is not a natural variant that normally occurs. And so he said, oh, it may not be HIV resistant. But another thing is that it may have just induced some crazy aggregation state for the protein. And now that person's going to get sick later in life from some disease we've never even seen before.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why it's risky to do things like this.
Yeah, but. And there's a lot of arguments on both sides. Like, so one is, I see what you're saying in terms of he can push it forward, right? We saw that with Pauling and Salk where, you know, instead of waiting to test certain vaccines on these broader populations in order to speed up what they were doing, they literally tested it on themselves. There's a history in science of people, individuals saying, I know this is the future. It's going to take a long time to do it. So instead, I'm going to jump the gun myself. And sometimes that's good and sometimes that's bad.
Isn't that a career ender in science now? Like if Salk were to do that today, would he basically...
I mean, when you save millions and millions of people, I think it ends up kind of justifying what you did. And you do so, by the way, giving the patents out for free when you could have otherwise been a billionaire in your time and saying instead, no, this is important. I'm going to give it out. I don't think anybody would really hold that against them.
And when you said that the kid, because of those deletion of amino acids, could get a disease later on, does that mean that they would possibly get some genetic disease that we haven't seen before, or they'd be susceptible to some disease that's rare that we haven't, like would they be more susceptible to a foreign body that we don't have to worry about now, or would they get some Huntington's genetic disease?
It could be anything. I mean, we don't really know that much about these systems. I think since it is sort of a cell receptor protein, and we know that you can be fine without it, and it just helps you not get HIV, the most likely negative consequences I can see is if having the slightly modified version that this caused maybe makes your cells stick in ways they weren't supposed to and mess up other normal processes or, provide a binding site for new things to get in. So there are so many potential things it can do, and just the fact that it's a sequence that hasn't existed in humans before, assumedly, means it's, you know, who knows what it's going to do.
And I'm going to ask the expert here because you're in front of me. Ballpark odds that this change will lead to superpowers?
I'm going to say less than 0.1%, most likely.
So there's a chance. Gotcha.
It depends on what your definition of superpower is. I mean, cancer is kind of like a superpower.
Yeah, it's out of control cell growth. Cells. Yeah.
No bones, man.
But it is, I mean, it's interesting to think about, too, because if you want to take the ethical route, you know, that we were just talking about, you're right. That's a mutation that, as far as we know, we haven't seen before. And so is it unethical to institute that mutation on that person? Well, maybe you could make the argument it is, but also somebody could reply and say, you know what else happens? Through meiosis and mitosis, we get random mutations all the time that don't exist or that we can't see otherwise in the population.
Don't produce superpowers.
So what's the difference if it happens naturally or if it happens because of some kind of lab process? In the end, it's the same thing. Why is there an ethical issue if we institute it as opposed to if it happens just based on the natural biology of the creature?
If life finds a way, fuck it, right?
Yeah, right? There's this weird ethical gray area that you get into where really what are we talking about? We're talking about gene modifications that theoretically could be completely natural, right? Even if we've never seen them in a person before through random recombination that we know happens when a sperm meets an egg, maybe this could happen in nature. So if it can, what's the difference if it happens in the lab? And then are there processes that we can do that couldn't naturally happen?
I brought this up on the show and you dismissed it, but I really think this is something we should look at. Could we use the potential threat of CRISPR technology to fight the potential threat or the eventual threat of AI technology? What I'm saying is,
we keep getting smarter when the machines get smarter.
We create huge-headed MODOK from the Marvel Universe looking people that can compete with these computers.
I do like that possibility.
And a warrior class of like Hulks.
Right.
I will get my superpowers in this fucking segment.
CRISPR really has no limits in terms of you can put in foreign DNA to a human if you wanted to. And when you think
Mexican DNA or like
like other species DNA. And when you think of all the, I mean, all of life is written in DNA, and all the crazy powers that life has across the spectrum and the different reactions and enzymes, you could maybe in the future say, oh, there's vitamin deficiency in this part of the world. Maybe I'm going to give an enzyme from this different species that can just synthesize this vitamin. And now humans won't even need it in their diet if we put it in ourselves.
Dr. Troy, I got one step further for you. How about this? What if through computer modeling, we can say, hey, here's a series of nucleic acids that if we put it in this series, it would produce this thing that has never been seen in any animal before. But theoretically, based on this computer model, this is the protein it would produce, and this is the result. And we think we can do this. So instead of stealing it from a bird or from a fish or something, you are creating it out of nothing from a computer and putting it into our DNA.
People have already done some protein design in vitro of just, you know, completely rational, AI-driven, not based on natural scaffolds. I think if we were actually going to be putting foreign things into ourselves, it's actually nice that we can steal from nature because that has already done the legwork of assuring that it works in a living system.
True.
And there are lots of...
But remember, you know, natural selection is not perfect. Natural selection works with the tools it has. If we have other tools that it doesn't have, we can do more than it. And a guided system is always going to be better than natural selection in terms of weeding out problems, because natural selection, you can have a problem, but as long as it works better than the other problem, it will still survive and replicate and stuff. Whereas we can optimize it to what works best, not just what doesn't work worst.
And in the not too distant future, will people do work on unnatural amino acids? All the proteins on Earth, for the most part, are just the same 20 amino acids in different combinations. And now we can synthesize metalloproteins and non-natural ones. And we're starting to figure out how to put those into living things. We have them working in bacteria and stuff. And so we can potentially, you know, there's like no limit to the kind of things we could do.
We could paint in colors that we've never seen, basically. Absolutely.
Putting foreign things into something is exciting, but there's a dark side to it. Ask anybody who's ever worked in an emergency room.
That's true. A lot of light bulbs. I don't know why. It seems like a weird choice.
Why glass?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, though. The whole compact fluorescence is really going to change that.
Like, here's the thing. Were you hooking his testicles up to car batteries and you were trying to see if it would light? Like, what's the...
They had an idea about butts. That's how it works.
Eureka.
All right, let's go on to article number two. We are upending the history of human evolution. So this is a very cool article that fits right in with a few other articles we have brought up over the past few years that really are changing our idea of how and where human beings evolved. So when I went through my undergrad, and this is what I specialized in and throughout undergrad, even though I was an anthropology major and I eventually ended up going into archaeology as a field, I was studying physical anthropology or human evolution for the most part. And if you would have talked to me when I went through my undergrad, what we were learning on the cutting edge was that, for the most part, the hominids that we know of evolved in East Africa, along Olduvai Gorge, Tanzania, Ethiopia, that area, right? And yeah, you had some stuff like Neanderthals kind of went off and they did their thing in Europe and Asia, and the Denisovans went out there as well, and then Homo ergaster went out to become Homo erectus in some of the other places. But most of the early stuff from 4 million on, maybe even earlier than that, happened in East Africa, because that's where the fossils were. That is where Lucy is. That's where you find Australopithecines. That's where you find Ardipithecus. That's where you find early Homo. Everything up until Homo erectus or so, Homo ergaster, is in that area. That's what we would have said back then. But increasingly, especially over the last few years, we are finding more and more evidence that that story is wrong in a staggering way, a very important way too, which is, it seems like hominids were not this in this little cradle in East Africa slowly evolving. It looks like they were around the entire continent, at least specifically throughout North Africa, which is a really big deal if you have any knowledge of Africa, because at least currently, right now, getting from that place in East Africa to North Africa is incredibly difficult. You have to go through the largest desert on the face of the earth.
You have to pass the Sphinx.
Yeah.
Answer the riddles.
I think you literally just mixed up sphinxes there. One's a statue.
Shut up.
And so this is a really big deal. We're finding more and more the fossil hominids or their remnants in North Africa.
Fuck you. The riddle of the Sphinx is a real thing. We're going to make, I'll start a Greek mythology podcast just to prove you wrong.
So this kind of trails on some other evidence. A while back, we found one of the earliest hominids, or the thing that we think is the basal branch that later became the hominids, named Sahelanthropus chadensis. We found that in Chad, hence the name Chadensis. Now, that is what we would consider the...
It's the broiest country.
Yes.
A lot of pop collars. Their dad owns dealerships.
In the most liberal sense, this would be considered the first hominid. So that is the first kind of kink in the armor. But you could explain it, because this is like, I think it's 7 million years old. When you're back in the 6-7 million year old range, you can say, all right, this is a broader range. But then they moved to East Africa, right? And that's where we got Ardipithecus, and then Australopithecus, and then early Homo, and then Homo erectus, and then we moved out? Turns out, no. We're finding different clues. Last year, the biggest story, in my opinion, or at least the least underreported story of the year, was last year, we almost doubled the length of time that we knew Homo sapien was on the face of this planet. Before then, for 40 years, the oldest Homo sapien fossil was the Omo fossil, and that was from East Africa, and that was a Homo sapien that was 180,000 years old. Last year, we found a 300,000-year-old Homo sapien fossil in Morocco. Thousands of miles away across what is now the largest desert on the face of the earth, we find the earliest Homo sapien. How is that possible? We expected to find this in East Africa, maybe South Africa, maybe. North Africa? Never. This is really breaking this open. What this research came out this week found was an even bigger mental leap in terms of our human history. What they found was stone tools dating back to about 2.6 million years ago. This is contemporary with the oldest stone tools on the face of the earth. Oldest stone tools right now belong to either, depending on who you ask, Homo habilis or Australopithecus garhi, both in East Africa. That is around the 2.6 million year mark. So this stuff that we're now finding in North Africa is at the same time period. We don't know who made it. We don't have the fossil remains of any of the hominids that made it. We do know that these are stone tools. They are being worked. The style is called Oldowan. It's a very specific, very primitive style of stone tools, but very definitive stone tools. These are not accidents. And these were made in North Africa 2.6 million years ago, meaning hominid ancestors were in Africa 2.6 million years ago. That's amazing. That turns the story of our evolution from this little ape in this tiny area of this one part of this continent to a more widely distributed group that was probably interbreeding, intermingling, competing for the longest time.
So human paleontology in Africa is not unlike American music here in North America, and that the East Coast just gets way more credit. Than,
that's
like,
right.
Lucy's like Bruce the Boss Springsteen of the East Coast gets a ton of credit. And like that Moroccan skeleton with the hat, with the fez hat, I imagine, is like the Tupac on the West Coast. You know, Biggie gets a movie. Tupac doesn't get
a movie. Well, he's in the Northwest, so he would really be more like a Kurt Cobain up in Seattle. I mean, that's the only way I would compare him.
Courtney Love is the real talent.
Right. So this is really, really big news. This really spreads out things. It also says we don't necessarily know where our genetics came from. Maybe there was mixtures and infusions from these constant areas. You might ask, why is it? Why has it been for the past 100-some-odd years all of the ancient fossils we have found of our ancient hominid brethren are in East Africa, and we're just now discovering this stuff in North Africa? And the answer is a little bit like that old thing about, you know, the guy, you come outside the bar and the guy is looking for his keys underneath the streetlight. And you say, why are you looking for your keys underneath the streetlight? And he said, I lost them. And they said, well, how did you know they're underneath the streetlight? And he says, well, that's the only place the light is. So that's where I'm going to look, right? That's been the case with East Africa for a long time.
Is the guy in this situation the Leakey family?
Kind of. Actually, somewhat it is. So the reason is Africa is splitting apart. The Great Rift Valley in Africa is actually two tectonic plates moving apart, creating this big open chasm. That chasm is exposing earlier layers of formation that otherwise wouldn't be exposed and giving us the ability to see deep down very easily. So all you have to do is, if you're a physical anthropologist, hike out through Olduvai Gorge, walk through, and eventually eroding out of the sides, you're going to find hominid fossils. Hominids live there. We have access to the early levels. That type of process is not taking place in North Africa. So you know what you have to do? You gotta fucking dig. Like, you have to actually look for these fossils. You have to dig down to the right spot. Hominids were rare enough that it's rare that just randomly digging is going to get you to a hominid layer in the exact place where hominids were. And so it's very unlikely to find it in those places. The reason we find them in East Africa is literally because nature does the digging for us. It's splitting
in the form of the honey badger.
No, in the form of plate tectonics splitting this continent apart so that we can just walk right out there on the surface and see an entire exposed layer.
In terms of finding fossils, does it really just come down to luck, or are there techniques of like acoustics or EM where you can probe under the surface and get an indication that there might be something there?
A lot of luck. But actually, I shouldn't say just luck, because it's actually a lot of luck mixed with a lot of skill. Fossil finding is a lot like any kind of thing that you're doing out there, which is pattern recognition. You have to be really good at pattern recognition. I could walk you guys through half of the late prehistoric sites we have here in San Diego, and you wouldn't even know you're in the middle of an archaeology site. Same is true with finding fossils. Most people, they think of finding fossils as seeing a giant dinosaur bone sticking out of the side of the wall. Anybody's going to notice that. Most fossils you're not going to notice, especially of hominids of this time period, because they're going to be small and they're going to be teeth. And if you can't distinguish between hominid teeth and pig teeth and badger teeth, it's not going to mean anything to you. So you have to be very, very talented, but then a lot of it's luck. The guy who found Lucy is going off to take a piss. It's a common story in archaeology. I'm going to take
a piss.
Sees
a lady at a conveyor belt.
Yeah.
Having trouble keeping up with the...
I can't tell you how much cool shit I have found going to take a piss. Because you're going to... Usually when you're going to take a piss, you're going to a private location, right? You're going away from the rest of the crew. So you're going someplace where somebody else hasn't checked before. That's usually why you find it there.
So that means almost everything you found with your dick out.
Well, that's true even just when I'm on a site for regular, you know? A lot
of sexual harassment claims on your site.
I like to assert power right away.
Warren Buffett does the same thing. Yeah. Don't look at me like that.
There's a lot of stories about LBJ doing that to reporters, actually. But yeah, so very, very interesting. This is broadening our scope of the story of human evolution, where we came from, how we came to be. It's really telling a detailed mosaic that we weren't just this group on this little island surviving it out in East Africa. There was this divergent group of hominids spread across the continent doing different things that probably were competing against each other, and that competition probably drove a lot of that evolution. So a very, very cool story that is starting to unfold in Africa that I guarantee you probably have not heard in the mainstream news.
Certainly, we have not heard the last of it on this show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Certainly, good Lord, this story will keep coming up.
And speaking of the last of it on this show, thank you, Dr. Troy, for coming out for Science Faction 280. And thank you, audience, for coming out where you learned about the origin of multicellular life, how we just got the world's first CRISPR babies, and how we're upending the story of human evolution. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back this Thursday for Science Faction 281.
With CRISPR technologies, average Americans like me can ensure that their children have the advantages that they never had. Like two dicks.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.